Good morning. This is Dave Mazza, and you're listening to Voices from the Edge. And once again, Joanne has taken wing. She's somewhere again. I'm not sure where, but she will be back next week. Meanwhile, we're going to plow ahead this morning with, I think, what you're going to find, a very interesting program. And we had actually, you know, in light of the financial crisis, considered suspending the program, going to Washington, and straightening out that whole Wall Street mess, but, eh, who likes flying back east anyway? So, we're going to instead take a look at another type of financial crisis this morning, one that's kind of been under the radar screen for a long time for a lot of folks. We're going to be looking at the plight of America's poor, and we're going to be doing that with Kath Weston, a anthropologist, who also an author, who's written a book called Traveling Light, On the Road with America's Poor, an interesting approach to studying what happens to so many of our folks who have been the victims of a globalized economy, of downsizing, and all the other ills that have hit us in the last few decades. And we'll talk a little bit about how she put this together, how she kind of takes this unique approach to studying the America's poor. But first, I want to remind you, of course, that we are in the middle of Pledge Drive. And for us to be able to keep doing the things we do here that you like to listen to, you're going to need to give us a call and make a pledge this day or sometime in this week. And you can do that by giving us a call at 503-232-8818 or toll-free at 877-500-5266 or online at www.kboo.fm. And now that I've given you many numbers, let me also remind you that to join us in the conversation, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. Well, let's get right into this. And first of all, let me just say good morning to Kath, and thank you very much for joining us this morning.
It's a pleasure. Good morning.
Well, Traveling Light, On the Road with America's Poor, a rather unique way of studying the sort of socioeconomic crisis that faces many people in this country. How did you, well, why don't you explain a little bit about what exactly it is you did and how you came up with this approach?
Okay. Well, in some ways, you know, it's a classic way of traveling the country and getting a sense of what's going on in the country. What I did is I took a road trip. But instead of climbing into a car, I got on and off buses for 5 years, for starting in 1999 when times were supposed to be booming, which they were for some people and not so much for others, and on up into 2003. It's unique in a couple of ways in the sense that the literature on road trips, there's not so much where you really there is a little bit in film, but not so much in books, where you see the kind of collective road trips that people take, especially when they are traveling with not too much money. Also, one of the reasons I designed the project this way was because if you look at literature on poverty, you see a lot of people portrayed as being in communities, whether those are urban communities or communities of rural poor, but they're pretty much staying still and sometimes portrayed as being stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you don't see too much on people who are poor but need to travel because they need to get to a new job, because someone in their family has passed away, because they're determined that they're going to find a way for their kids to see another part of the country than the one where they grew up in. People travel for all kinds of reasons, and they often do it on very little money. So, in fact, I designed this not so much as a study. I've written four other books. They're all scholarly books. They're all framed as studies. This one's a little different. I wanted this book to be in the tradition of American literature, the kind of social commentary that writers were writing in the 60s when I was growing up, because we know a lot about poverty, quote unquote, or even what I call living poor. How people spend their days, what they do to get by. There's lots of books written on that. There are lots of numbers collected. And yet, you know, you've probably heard this catchphrase, the widening gap between rich and poor, it's only been getting wider. so I'm hoping that this book, with its characters, its dialogue, its, as you put it, a unique approach, will get people really thinking about, you know, what we need to do to have that kind of political will as a nation to start doing more about this, because, frankly, things are getting worse, not better.
Well, and I was going to say, I think the thing that I, one of the things I found so compelling about this was your ability to fold together the analysis with this sort of road literature approach, which I think has just been wonderful and such more illuminating than simply kind of piling on the statistics. Kath, how did you go about this? I mean, did you get on the bus and be a fly on the wall of the bus, or, you know, was there a plan to interact with folks? Tell us a little bit about the nuts and bolts of putting this together.
Well, you know, I tried to have my own reason for writing. So the book opens with, it's organized into different journeys that have different themes. One might be militarization and its links to poverty, or, you know, each one has its theme. So the first one opens up, and I'm trying to get to my nephew's high school graduation because I wanted to have stories to trade as well. And part of the time that I was working on the book, I was also between jobs, as people like to say, but I was unemployed. So where I was coming from was a little bit different over the course of those 5 or 6 years that I was writing.
You come out of a working class background, right?
I do.
So
yeah. My father had one of those good jobs, quote-unquote, steady jobs, delivering mail for the U.S. Postal Service. Four kids in the family. My mom wasn't working while we were growing up. So, you know, we had in the sense that he had a government job, we had a certain amount of stability there, but money was always very, very tight, down to literally the last dime, you know, when payday would roll around.
Well, we're going to go to the phone lines because we have a caller on the line. And for folks who would like to join us in this conversation with Kath Weston, author of Traveling Light, On the Road with America's Poor, give us a call at 503-231-8187. So let's go to the phone lines. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for taking my call. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning.
Thank you for your very important work. I was wondering perhaps you could react to one of my observations, which has been that the great difference between those of us who have so little and those of us who have so much happens to, and it, from my perception at least, happens to, or comes often in the form of gratitude. I find the poorer that not just I am, but the poorer I am, the more grateful I am, oddly enough. But that seems to be a prevalent thing, that the wealthiest amongst us feel that their purchase power is their gratitude, and that the gratitude, the real gratitude, comes when you don't, you can't paper it over with simply dollars and purchase power. And I'll take your response off the air, but I'm wondering if you have any reaction to that. Thanks again, Dave.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, that's a really interesting question. You know, it brings to mind a study that was done recently where they were actually looking at working poor. Of course, you can be poor and not be working, but these are people who are actually earning around $10,000, and they compared them to people with incomes over $100,000, and they found that as a percentage of their income, the people who were living on incomes around $10,000 were giving a higher percent of their income away. The kind of generosity that might appear in my book, Traveling Light, where people are sharing food or sharing childcare or teaching each other music or artwork, you know, that kind of generosity is not just anecdotal, but it's actually being borne out in terms of, you know, what people do with their cash. And so together with that goes, I think, a kind of appreciation. But I wonder if I might also take off on it and make another point.
Oh, please do.
Yeah, it's true that, you know, that when you're looking at income and wealth, that there is this, everyone's talking about the split. People are, you know, we've got films now with titles like The Collapse of the Middle Class. People, I think, are beginning to become, you know, acutely aware of that split. But at the same time, you know, there's a way in which we are all connected. Often people who have a certain amount of economic security at the moment or more privilege aren't always so appreciative of that, so appreciation in a different sense.
Connected.
One of the things you realize riding the bus, because you're not going to a designated, you know, poor neighborhood somewhere, is how easy downward mobility has become. I mean, you have people who get on the bus, sit down next to you, and say, I just hate to travel like this, you know. It's so lower class. It's not a word I would use, but they might use it. Because, you know, they basically, their economic circumstances only now permit them to travel that way. And we're living at a time in a country where, you know, even before investment banks started going bust, you know, we don't have a decent health care system. It takes one accident where you don't have health insurance, or one accident that where you exceed your health insurance benefits, you know, to really, you know, bring you down into a very different situation in the world. Given how easy downward mobility has become in this country, you know, there's a kind of a illusion or a false sense of separation as well.
Well, Kath, once again, we're going to just take a quick moment here, first of all, to remind folks that we have a lot of great programming coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9, it's a special one-hour press watch. Host Teresa Mitchell speaks with David Ray Griffin about his new book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, 9-1-1, The Cover-Up, and The Exposé. At 10, on Radio Beyond Borders, host Mia Kim presents a documentary on the Portland Immigrant Leadership and Organizing Training Program. At 10:30, on Art Focused, host Julie Bernard guests is Hilary Pfeiffer, whose current show at Ogle Gallery is called Natural Selection. And at 11, it's Air Cascadia News Headlines and Commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. And at 11:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein presents a scathing critique of the presidential candidates and their links to the Wall Street crisis, and he interviews investment banker and analyst Catherine Austin Fitz. Just a few reasons to keep that dial at 90.7 FM. For those of you who may just be tuning in, you're listening to Voices from the Edge. This is Dave Mazza. Joanne is not with us today, but we'll be back next week. And we're talking this morning with Kath Weston, author of Traveling Light, On the Road with America's Poor. Kath, let's kind of pick up where we were there before our little diversion onto detour into the pledge break. I'm losing my ability to speak. You know, one of the things you were talking a little bit about, you know, downward mobility and the, you know, the sort of sometimes, I guess, the anxiety that causes and the sort of separation that's involved in a middle class that's feeling these pressures. One of the things that struck me in reading about the people that you talk about in this book is, despite these incredible forces that one would think would tend to generate a sense of isolation and distrust, there's a tremendous amount of openness and people willing to share and talk. And you know, what? How do you explain that?
Well, you know, I talk in the book, I talk a little bit about how there's a lot of artistry involved in living poor. You know, when you pick up books that are, you know, advertise themselves as being on poverty, a lot of times they'll talk about you need coping skills, they use words like survival, but they don't really think so much about it as a kind of art, okay? I mean, it involves a way of connecting to people. If you have a person who's got work in one job, maybe two jobs, and they still have to go out on the street to ask people for spare change to make ends meet, you know, they cultivate, I've heard some really fine orators out there, they cultivate the arts of banter, you know. So, you know, you have that sort of thing going on, and it requires a kind of a connection. You know, it's not that you can't live poor and feel incredibly isolated or depressed and not want to roll out of bed. Of course, you know, you can find yourself reacting that way too. But I agree with you. The people I talked to, there was a lot of openness. And the thing also is, when you're in a place and you're traveling together, like on the bus, and people are getting on and off, and, you know, even people who would describe themselves as shy would say, geez, I've been on the bus for 48 hours or more, you know, you eventually start talking. And the woman across the aisle from you, you know, opens up her traveling bag that looks like an ordinary traveling bag, and inside are all these beautiful beads in different colors, and she turns out to be a master bead worker who's working on a pair of moccasins and has to have them finished by the time she gets to Oklahoma, to the powwow where she's going to give to her niece. You know, that's a conversation starter right there. Mm-hmm. So that openness, I think, is also cultivated by you know, the kind of situation in which you find yourself. Now, you know, that's not to say that there aren't situations in which people, you know, do have a kind of sometimes a healthy mistrust, and people have to also cope with a certain amount of abuse from the guards who are now patrolling stations, which close at night, from drivers who some of them are terrific, and some of them, you know, will have quite abusive, racist, you know, kind of exchanges of words with their passengers. So it runs the gamut. But as you say, it is, you know, it's hopeful in a way. I mean, you'd think, gee, you spend 5 years studying, you know, people struggling and scrambling to get by, you know, wouldn't this be depressing? But actually, I personally found it, inspiring, and it was really good for me as someone who's done a lot of, you know, class crossing over the course of her life, to be able to hang out with people, you know, in that way and hear again the kind of music that's in people's voices, certain ways of talking, certain ways of relating and coming to the assistance of people who are, they're basically strangers. They just got on the bus, you know, and maybe you feel like you know them pretty well because you've been riding for a day and a half together, but actually, you know, you're basically strangers. So when, you know, there's one point in the book where someone, this guy almost gets arrested during a stop in Flagstaff, Arizona. He's African-American. A white woman calls the police and says he's doing some kind of witchcraft, and she's actually trying to hit him, and the police are reacting by trying to arrest the African-American guy. Now, some passengers interceded, got him back on the bus, and because this was a lunch stop, a woman in the front sent her husband back with homemade burritos because she figured he you know, hadn't had time to get anything to eat. And then over the course of riding again for miles and miles, it becomes evident that basically even if he hadn't been hassled by the police and almost been threatened with arrest for no reason whatsoever, he wouldn't have eaten anyway because he had he was riding all the way from Phoenix to Oklahoma, and he had no money on him to buy food. And the real irony here is that, you know, why was he riding? He was riding because, as he said, he had a job waiting for him in Oklahoma in food processing. That is to say, working in a meatpacking plant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a kind of commentary, I think, on what's going on in this nation, that you can have people who can't even afford to eat, you know, who are basically the ones who are responsible for putting the food on the tables of other people.
Many other Americans.
Yes.
We're speaking this morning with Kath Weston, author of Traveling Light, On the Road with America's Poor, a remarkable record of what life is like for many Americans who have been taking the brunt of the globalization of our economy and the transition from a kinder, gentler nation to the place we find ourselves today. If you want to join us in that conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Another aspect, I think one of the things that this book helps illustrate is there's a tendency in not only in academic circles that are looking at the poor, but even among say progressives who have an interest in improving the plight of the poor, of talking about them in just that way, the poor, and there's a tendency to strip them of not only the type of humanity you've been describing in terms of interpersonal reaction, but also in terms of an intellectual aspects, in that the poor generally aren't credited with, you know, doing an analysis of what, you know, what's going on around them, what's affecting their environment. And this book really seems to counter that, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, people engaging in substantive conversations.
Yes, you know, because a lot of things actually, you know, come up on the bus that are worthy of commentary. And, you know, I try to make the case that the bus is really has become an arena for civic debate. And there was a time when the progressive media were filled with a lot of almost bemoaning the death of civic debate in this country. And I thought to myself, well, all you have to do is, you know, go down to Greyhound or Trailways, get a ticket, you know, go on a run that where the coach is full, and you're going to hear a civic debate because something will come up. So, you know, one person will be looking for a job. You'll get a commentary on the state of the Veterans Administration hospitals. You know, so there'll be a debate about, like, the pros and cons of joining the military because somebody's, you know, basically going to who has enlisted and is going to report on that run. You might pass places that are really polluted, and you'll get all kinds of debate on the state of the environment. I mean, you name it, and it could come up.
Well, we're going to go back to the phone lines because we have a caller, and if you want to join us in this conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We have Gordon on the line. Good morning, Gordon. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Good. So, yeah, I'm in the poorhouse, but it's only on my own. It's because I want to be in the fact that I am trying to take care of my children, and I don't want other people taking care of my children for me. Mm-hmm. So me and my wife have decided to cut hours and to be with our children all the time and also have them in school. But I want to be, I have been a father that has been in the position of seeing the first footstep, the first word, the first, you know, bite of food. I have got to experience more than most fathers have got to experience because they're all shoved down into the work system. So I like the fact that I've been there for my children, and I like the fact that I know what's going on and what's clicking with them, which puts me in a position of making less money and having to struggle on a kind of on a daily basis to live. But it's because we decided not to do the child care and all that stuff. But if we look at the world economy and all this stuff, that was inevitable. We already know that. But I think what's really going on is, and it's criminal, is that, let's say, for example, the engineers in India serve right next to the engineers in the United States in college. The engineer goes to India, he makes $15,000. The engineer in the United States makes $75,000. So you have the corporate mentality going, well, wait a second, we need to take that $75,000 and cut that down to make him equal with the guy in India. Well, they both have the same education. They're both doing the same thing. But, you know, what's really funny is they take half the $75,000, drop you down without a notification or anything, but they don't give the guy that's making the $15,000 any of the money. So I would be willing, if I'm making $75,000 and a guy doing the same thing as making $15,000 in India, I'd be willing to give him $20,000. I would be willing to equalize that. But what's really messed up is the corporation takes the money from me and then doesn't even give it to the engineer that needs to be raised up in his living style.
Well, Kath, in your experience here on during the 5 years, how many of the folks you were dealing with were sort of in the globalization trap that Gordon was just talking about?
Well, you know, I would say that a lot of them, you know, and a lot of also it's you're riding through places, right? It's about places in America and not just about people. So, you know, for example, we go through Rochester in the night, Rochester, New York, and the bus driver basically said, you know, this is one of the most dangerous cities on the route. You can get out at this restaurant, but anyone who doesn't get out now, I'm going to lock you in the bus for your own safety. And that prompted a whole commentary on not to pick on Rochester, but basically on how globalization has affected the companies there, the employment there. And it's ironic because I did a little research on Rochester, and that's one of the places where in the era of so-called the earlier eras of where capitalism was trying to basically invent things like pensions and so on and so forth, earlier in the 20th century, you know, a lot of the companies like Kodak, like Xerox, you know, they were active there, and they were inventing this kind of system that's now undergoing these radical changes, some of them or many of them, you know, connected to the multinationalizing of corporations and globalization. So, you know, definitely you see that you know, you see that on the bus. And these are policy issues connected to this. I mean, I think your caller, Gordon, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about, well, you know, I might be willing to, you know, take 20,000 of that, or, you know, split something, or work out a different kind of deal. But all these things are being mediated by institutions, by laws. You know, you can see it right now. You know, you may have heard people get on the air and say, well, you know, I'm still paying my mortgage. It's not easy, but, you know, if it's going to be sold for 60 cents on the dollar, why not let me, you know, pay that 60 cents on the dollar so I can continue to live in my house with security? But, of course, you know, that's not the kind of, you know, way that the system that's in crisis right now is being reinvented.
Right. Well, we're speaking with Kath Weston, author of Traveling Light, On the Road with America's Poor, and we'll be... Kath, let's see. One of the things,
Dave, I wondered if I could pick up on one other point your last caller made.
By all means.
And he was talking about basically being in a situation that gets called voluntary poverty, where, you know, taking a pay cut in order to spend more time with his kids and so forth. Now, I did meet a few people on the bus who would have described themselves as being in that set situation. One guy in particular, I nickname him in the book the Philosopher King, in a little section called The Philosopher King Does Sacramento. But he was a guy who spent most of his time riding the rails and was just, you know, on the bus for a short stretch. But he talked to me about, like, how he had it all. He had the great job, the boat, the this, the that, and a brother who was still saying, geez, you know, why do you live this life? You could have it again. And he just spoke so eloquently about what it meant to him to live a simpler life with fewer attachments, and also to get to see the country and experience a different kind of community of people who were riding the rails, something that never, ever, ever would have happened to him if he had continued in that older kind of life. But at the same time, you know, I think we have to ask ourselves the question, you know, what does it mean that people are faced with the choice, if they want to spend time with their kids, you know, that they have to, you know, enter into some sort of voluntary poverty a lot of times, rather than, it says something about the way that work is being restructured, partly, you know, because of things going on with globalization, but not only that. It's something that people who have a lot of money and people who have little money have in common. They don't have a lot of extra time, because the people who are in low-wage jobs are having to work two or even three of them to get by, and the people who are in higher-wage jobs are supposed to be, you know, hooked in and basically on call all the time. It's a problem. There are other things in life.
Right. Well, and of course, you know, the problem being that the model says all those sorts of things you've just described represent greater efficiency and productivity, makes the stock market go up, and therefore we have a successful economy.
So, you know, I mean, I think it was Emerson who basically made an argument back in his day that one needed to redefine success.
Mm-hmm.
Success wasn't just success in business. And the same thing with productivity. You know, if productivity is just a code word for asking one person, you know, to impair their health because they're now doing the job that used to be done by two people, then productivity sounds good on the face of it, but one really has to ask, you know, what are we actually talking about here? I think that, you know, we'll certainly, jobs are important. We always hear a discussion of jobs, but I also think, after talking to so many people riding around the country, that we need to deal with what Doug Henwood has called the workhouse economy as well, because, you know, too much work can kill you too. You know, we need, you know, quote unquote good jobs, but they have to be structured in such a way that they're life sustaining for people.
One of the things I know you're going to have to be leaving us here in a few minutes to go teach a class, but one of the things I did want to touch on, and you touched on it briefly before, was the different relationship between people on the bus and authorities. And in the book, for example, you talk about the experience bus riders have with the Immigration Service.
Yes.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, the face that bus drivers see of immigration, which is far different than what, you know, most people end up seeing.
Well, I mean, to be fair to the bus drivers, they're getting a certain amount of, I mean, they're working too. And, you know, they're working in jobs where the rules are changing, and their jobs have been, their companies have been downsized after the great Greyhound strikes of the 80s. So, and they're getting new initiatives. There was, I don't know if this actually went all the way through, but they were under a certain amount of pressure that if that they would be held responsible in some way, you know, if they carried people who didn't have papers to make it illegal for them to be in the country. And geez, if you've ever ridden a bus, it's an impractical and ridiculous demand to make on someone who needs their job. You know, they need to keep working.
I just wanted to pay attention to the road is basically all I care about.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, you know, I mean, the buses have been the target for, immigration raids for some time now, and I do describe one that happens while I'm writing. You're pretty much a captive audience, and so it makes it very easy. And they're, to be pulled over and for people to get on and to demand identification or, you know, what have you. At the same time, there have been a number of very historic lawsuits about situations in which police stopped the bus and basically, demanded certain things and, again, you know, did have people there as a certain kind of captive audience. It's a tough situation. You might feel that you have to give consent, but it's a very coercive consent if the alternative is that you're going to be, you know, put down at the side of the road with your bags or all your worldly possessions in the middle of, you know, who knows where, and you spent your last money on a bus ticket. It's pretty hard to not to go along with the kind of request that people who are in authority give you, because the drivers, you know, do have the authority to make decisions if people are being disruptive or this or that. You know, they can and will put them off the bus.
Well, Kath, we're going to be going back here in just a second to Molly and Randall to talk about Pledge Drive, and I know you have to get off to teach a class. I want to thank you very much for being with us this morning to talk about your book, Traveling Light on the Road with America's Poor. It's a wonderful book, very enlightening, a very unique way for people to get insight into what's happening to way too many Americans, and to get a feel for more of who those people are. So, again, thank you for joining us this morning on KABU.
I really appreciate it, Dave, and I hope, if your listeners get a chance to read the book, I'll tell you one thing they will find there that there's no way I can recreate for them in a radio interview is you get a chance to hear the voice, the cadence, as I say, the music in people's speech as well as what they have to say of the real diversity, you know, of people who are living poor right now in this country. So thanks again.
Thank you. And again, we've been talking with Kath Weston, author of Traveling Light on the Road with America.